don't, but I
very bad at
I know, I know. But I sit right next to her, so I must. All right. People can interrupt me at any point if they would like. And I talk really fast, so we'll be out at 6:30, so it's all good. So I'm going to hand out two things to you because you are all legally interested. And as people legally interested, then you will absolutely, I know, want to get training in what is very much part of the cutting edge of legal training as well as clinical ethics training, and that is mediation as a mode of conflict resolution. It's, of course, in the law called alternative dispute resolution, and it's really gaining foothold. In fact, a couple of years ago, there was one clinic, my understanding was, at the law school, and everybody fought and clawed to get into it. Now there's three sections taught by three different instructors at the law school reflecting that even the highly theoretical, not so practical Penn law, that wasn't recorded, is actually trying to get on the curve here as training mediators. So we do that too here. In fact, we have the only clinical ethics mediation program in the country. There's one certificate in New York that's a couple of days long. Ours is very elaborate and it's very hands-on. So it's quite lucky that you all are here where we've just launched this. And there are two workshops. There is one that is spring break and there is one that is in May. And the one that is spring break, we're considering moving to two weekends in April to see if people who are upset that they can't get in spring break because they have to go to Florida and be on the beach might be able to be accommodated with this semester's tuition. In other words, if you are someone who gets tuition benefits at the law school or the med school, it doesn't really apply to folks who have full-time jobs because their tuition benefits go year-round. But if you're at the law school or the med school, then you only are allowed to take courses outside of those two places in the regular semester. And so the May and August don't enable the med students and the law students to take this workshop, whereas if you are at the med school and the law school and you want to take the one in March, or if we do it in April, then your tuition would actually cover it. So I'm going to pass both of these out. There are two different ones, one for May and one for March. If you would be interested in the April and you can't make the March, but that's something you would be interested in doing, then let me know, because I got to make the decision in the next day or two about whether I'm going to switch the dates. If we do the one in April, it'll be back to back. Saturday, Sunday, so no one will have to miss any classes and no one will have to miss any work. It'll be a 9-to-5 workshop. It's a half credit class. When you take two of these, you get one full credit. If you're at the law school, that means three credits. So these are each 1.5 credits because you use a different system. Oh, here come lawyers, and I've just given this whole spiel about the law school, so we have to repeat everything. Oh my God. Any rate, what I'm saying is each of these is 1.5 credits if you're at the law school. Together, they're 3 credits at the law school, or if you're in our program, they're 1 CU together. If you don't want to take two or you can't fit in two, but you want the full CU for us, or 3 credits at the law school, you can add a paper to either one of these, and then you'll have a full 3 credit or 1 CU class. So, like I said, thinking about moving it to back-to-back weekends, April 2nd, 3rd, 9th, 10th, so that people don't have to miss any work, let me know. Either way, passing both of these out. You know what? Let's divide half and half and slide them down. That's not half, so that will be, you know, unhelpful. Start there. If you're interested at all, we run these workshops 4 times a year, so speak to me even if these dates don't work out. And Ed Bergman is talking on the 28th, and we'll have him re-advertise for us, so that'll be good. You get hit twice. What'd you say? Exactly. You'll have heard me talk. You'll have heard him talk. If you don't like either one of us, I say skip it. Though actually, it's all games all the time, which is the unique part of our training workshop. We do very little talking about mediation. We get in there and you just start mediating. And the thing about clinical ethics mediation is mediation is mediation is mediation. In other words, the techniques that you use are the exact same in the Harvard Negotiation Project, in the clinical ethics program we do, and in mediation that they're offering at the law school. It's all mediation and it all translates. So grab it while you can, especially if you've got tuition benefits and it would be free for you.
Are they different subjects?
So what happens is they are different games. we run this 4 times a year, and many people who are getting the certificate, which you can add on to the master's program, are going to actually take it 4 times. Because the more you do it, the more comfortable you get and the better at it you are. But the structure is exactly the same. So if you hated it once, you'll hate it the second time too. But what we've actually found is that we've run it 3 times, and we have had a significant portion of the class be there for the 3rd time. So what's happening is new people are, for some of them, like May, having a hard time getting in because it's bottlenecking as people take it over and over again. But spring break was not, I think, an ideal choice for us because most people, as I said, want to be elsewhere. So that's the one that we're having a little bit of wiggle room. But they are exactly the same in structure. The culmination is our bringing in actors from Philadelphia, spectacular actors. In fact, that's what the advertising is. If you saw some advertisements for some of the local theater productions, those are the actors we bring in here. It's really a spectacular end of the session where you all are mediating, but these folks are playing in a way that you would not think that they're playing it. It's having patients and families and doctors all in a room and being able to get an experience that does not feel faux in any way. In fact, what's strange about the workshops is that none of it feels artificial. When you're there and the students are actually participating in a serious way, you actually feel like you really are mediating serious conflict. So there you go. Any other questions on that? See me if you're interested and pass on the word. Alrighty, then here we go. So I'm going to talk, as you know, about legal cases in the end of life. I'm a philosopher, not a lawyer, so I'm not going to try to jump too far into the deep end of law, and we will trespass on your knowledge to help us, especially because there's a mixture here of folks who are lawyers or at least law students, and folks who are thinking about law school, and certainly we have some lawyers, because obviously John's a lawyer, but who can help us understand some of the fine points about trial courts and appellate courts and federal system and state system, and that's going to be important. So in understanding the legal cases at the end of life, both as withdrawal and withholding cases, which will be the first part of my talk, and as physician-assisted suicide cases. So when we get to the first couple of slides and that becomes important, we're going to turn it over to the people in the room who know so that we can all get on the same page. Because if you're not, oh, there are more lawyers. I'm seeing them around the table. So we got a lot of people who can help us. But for those of you who are not legally trained, the two systems of appeals from the state and the federal system actually gets things quite complicated, especially when we try to understand which kind of cases and precedent govern and have jurisdiction over various parts of the country. So look for me to tap into your expertise when we get there so you can explain in a more coherent way than I can. All righty, I'm going to give you what I think are I'm going to give you, see, I know, right? You didn't know how fast I actually talk. You missed the whole class, Stacy. It's over. So this is the set of the cases that I'm going to talk about, but I'm going to tell you that the 2001 Wendland versus Wendland is a withdrawal and a withholding case, as is Vacco versus Quill, Washington versus Gluck. Oh, did I just say that wrong? Let me say it again. Wendland versus Wendland is a withdrawal case. So it actually follows in the presentation right after Cruzan. The last case I'll talk about for withdrawal cases is the Wendland case. The PAS, physician-assisted suicide cases, are Washington, Vacco, and Gonzalez. But I wanted to give you the chronology of what I consider to be the highlight. And anyone else giving a presentation could make different choices about what the key moments are here in the legal history of end of life. This is how I see it, and if you've got other cases you want to supplement this conversation with, please add it, absolutely. But when we're actually talking about the cases, as I said, I'm going to break this down into two areas because the legal discussion looked very different. It's got a very different history. So I'm going to talk about cases of withdrawal of life-sustaining therapies, and I'm going to think about ventilators and food and hydration. And then I'm going to talk about physician-assisted suicide, which does not have nearly the legal history. In fact, what you're going to find is that Vacco and Glucksberg were heard by the Supreme Court at the very same time, right around the time that the first Death with Dignity Act was passed in the state law, the state of Oregon. So we don't have a long legal tradition when it comes to PAS. When it comes to cases of withdrawal, we're going to be going back to the 70s, and that really kicks off a lot of aspects of bioethics. It really has a launching effect in bioethics. It's not just what happens in the law. What happens in the law very much has reverberations and implications for what happens in bioethics proper. So let's start. I'm going to put the starting point of the contemporary understanding and approach to withdrawal at Quinlan in 1975. For each of these cases, I'm going to give a background human interest story. Then I'm going to give the legal facts as a philosopher understands them, so, you know, buckle your seatbelt. And then we're going to talk about what the implications are for that legal case. And as we do it, we're going to want to keep in mind what cases were binding of which had jurisdiction and in which ways. So Quinlan is going to turn out to have been a New Jersey Supreme Court decision. Is not a U.S. Supreme Court decision. That means it came up through the New Jersey state system. It's not federal. And the implications then for the country were then limited in a literal way, but not in a social and cultural way, I think is fair to say. Now I'm going to keep looking at John. If he shakes his head no, then be like, okay, that's wrong. Okay, let's look at some of the facts. April 15th, 1975 is when 21-year-old Karen Ann Quinlan stopped breathing for two 15-minute periods. The thought is that maybe it was one of those fad diets where you tried to get, you know, 700 calories liquid and all, something like that. Could have been in combination with alcohol. She was at home. They tried to revive her. They got her breathing, but she was in a persistent vegetative state with no higher cognitive function. The fact that she's in a persistent vegetative state is going to play very heavily when the New Jersey Supreme Court gets to this case. And it's going to be a sharp distinction between Quinlan and Cruzan on the one hand, where we have a PVS state, an individual like Schiavo in a PVS state, versus the case I'm going to talk about, Bouvet, where we have full cognitive capacity, and Wendland, where we have something in between. We have consciousness, certainly not competence, and that will be, I think, the litmus test for how far the law thinks that we can go in having surrogates withdraw care in non-terminal cases. So it is not terminal, it is not, Wendland is not PVS. But we're going to start with the most dramatic of cases, and that is PVS, no higher function. And as I said, the courts really cared about this, especially, and this is why I'm bringing it up, because she needed 24-hour care. Everything for her bodily function had to be performed by the medical personnel, from breathing to eating, catheters, antibiotics. She couldn't sustain her functions in any way. Interestingly, as a side note, the Quinlans were a very devout Catholic family. I'm saying interestingly because, as you know, when we fast forward to 2000 and whatever, five, to Schiavo, Catholicism rears its head in a very profound way. The Quinlans felt themselves to be very devout, very much the mass-going, Pope-following Catholic, and yet they were the ones who pursued the withdrawal of care for Karen Ann. I want to say another thing at the out of the starting gate here about the Quinlan case that is very different from today's mores and culture about withdrawal and withholding, and that is that the withdrawal here was instigated by the family, and the conflict was between, as it usually is, the patient's family and provider, but in the exact opposite way that we see it today. Today, if there is a family-provider conflict at the bedside, it is almost universally, especially in a PVS state, the other way around, with the providers talking about things like futility and wasted resources and why are we doing this and let's withdraw, and family saying, absolutely, under no circumstances will you withdraw. When there's a conflict, most of the time there isn't a conflict, and then we don't hear about those cases. But when we do, today, it tends to be the family, like the Schindlers, arguing that we should not withdraw care against the providers who tend to be uniformly in favor of withdrawal. Here, It's the hospital, the providers, who are refusing to withdraw care, and her father, her family, who are asking for the withdrawal. Another thing that I want to flag so that we don't get confused here about the kind of case this is that an issue for the courts is not about the quality of the surrogate. This is not a dispute about whether Joseph Quinlan has the correct understanding of Karen Ann's wishes. It's not actually a surrogate case, as Cruzan absolutely will be. This is a case about whether a patient herself has the right to have a ventilator withdrawn, even though it is life-sustaining. The entire discussion that will happen here around the Quinlan case will be acting as if Quinlan, Joseph Quinlan, and Karen Ann Quinlan are the same voice. By the time we get to Cruzan, Cruzan's parents and Nancy Cruzan will be considered very distinct entities, and the discussion will be, what does Nancy want? That's how much influence Quinlan and the dialogue that happens afterwards has, how much impact it has by the time we get to a discussion like Cruzan. Now we're saying, of course a patient could decide this for herself. That's what's at issue here. But what does a surrogate know about what a patient would want? That's what's going on with the Schindlers and Michael Schiavo. It's what does Terry Schiavo want? It's not, does Terry Schiavo have the right to have a ventilator? It's food and hydration, actually. Food and hydration removed. By the time we get to Schiavo, we're way past that in terms of food and hydration. Of course you can. By the time we get to Cruzan in 1990, we're way past wondering whether an individual can have a ventilator removed if she so chooses. And we're all in the realm of surrogate, and we will be from then on. But we're talking here not about surrogate at all. And you're going to see this when we reference the Jehovah's Witness. At this point, we're actually asking whether Karen Ann Quinlan, were we to know what she would want, does Karen Ann Quinlan have the right to make this decision? Okay, so here comes the legal battle. The trial court in New Jersey denies Joseph Quinlan's request. And then the case goes to the New Jersey Supreme Court. And that's going to be the highest court of New Jersey, and its ruling will govern the state of New Jersey. Here's something really interesting, at least from my non-legal perspective, but I think if for anyone, it's interesting. Quinlan's lawyers argued for withdrawal of care from Karen Ann Quinlan based on two parts of the Constitution, the First Amendment, freedom of religion, and the Eighth Amendment, that this was a kind of cruel and unusual punishment to be trapped in a body like this. The court isn't going to like either one of these arguments. They're going to say, actually, that neither one of these arguments are plausible at all. In fact, they're quite ridiculous, the court is going to say. And yet, interestingly, the court is going to find for Joseph Quinlan. So the court is going to give Quinlan's lawyer the better argument so that they can win. So the lawyers didn't come in on the, as you now know, 14th Amendment, but that's where the court is going to come down on the 14th Amendment. You're squinting at me. When I'm wrong, you just got to flag it here. Okay, so this is what the court says. They say of the First Amendment, the state's interest in preserving, yes, it's freedom of religion, but the state has an interest in preserving life that will outweigh religious freedom. And look what they say here. And then you can tell me what's weird about this. For the sake of life, courts sometimes order blood transfusions for the Jehovah's Witness. What's interesting about that? This is no longer true, right? But this tells you how located we are in 1975, where clinicians can actually tell someone from the religion Jehovah's Witness that they must have blood transfusions. Today, there's not a doctor, not a hospital in America who would impose on a Jehovah's Witness someone who was who was part of that faith and a competent adult. No clinician in America would impose a blood transfusion on a Jehovah's Witness member. No way. The courts are way beyond that now. But there is a paternalism in 1975 that does not exist anymore, and that's how radically things have shifted in those 35 years. And the court is able to talk about the weakness in the religious freedom argument by using an analogy to the way we treat Jehovah's Witness. Now, of course, we know that today we don't treat Jehovah's Witness like that, so perhaps the religious freedom argument actually has some more power. But as they use precedent to think through new cases, they are using what we typically do in 1975 with Jehovah's Witness to nix the First Amendment argument that Quinlan's lawyers present. And then on the Eighth Amendment, they say they're going to shoot that right out of the water because cruel and unusual punishment metaphorically might be able to be talked about being trapped in a body like that and whatever. But that statute is actually about criminal sanction, and we can't stretch that far. So neither the First Amendment nor the Eighth Amendment argue that a patient ought to be able to decide to forego life-sustaining therapy. But in their legal decision, they argue that there is a constitutional right to privacy that permits one to refuse medical treatment, and I have this in italics, under certain circumstances. This is the first foray out. It's very circumscribed. It is limited, and they are very careful to talk about how it is very much under certain circumstances. In fact, they're going to look at the 14th Amendment, and they're going to see in the Due Process Clause, where we get so many of the other substantive rights that have to do with birth control and abortion and all of those rights. That's where people look in the 14th Amendment. But what they're going to argue is that it has to be curtailed. They're going to refer in this case to two precedents, and I'm sure you're familiar with both. In fact, I would imagine that a bioethics course would at some point be having to refer to both of these, but let's do Roe versus Wade first. It's so obvious. We probably don't need to say what it is. So that's the, obviously, yeah, we're not going to talk about it. How about Griswold versus Connecticut? I know half the room thinks that's an obvious question too, but let's just get that one out. Oh, right, and we're going to admit it, right? Okay, raise your hand if you want to be the dummy that does it. Oh, look at the people admitting it. Good for you. And you're brave. There were seven brave people in here. Okay, how about somebody who does?
I know Roe versus Wade.
Thank you. Then you can stay. what do we know here about Griswold? When is it approximately? What is it? Married couples want to have some birth control. No. Yeah, that's the case that decides that absolutely, if you are married, you can have birth control. Again, not necessarily if you're not married, but this is like a 1968 case? 65. Okay. Not in time for me, but there you go. All right. Griswold versus Connecticut. The right to privacy protects the rights of married persons to use birth control. And Roe versus Wade, the right to privacy, this is where this idea that right to privacy is fundamental. That fundamental thing is going to rear its head in many cases from then on. And it's trying to limit the government's ability to curtail freedoms, including abortion. So this is the line of reasoning that says that privacy is actually broad enough to understand my right to refuse medical treatment. And that is how it's talked about. It's about the individual. Were she competent, that's the rub, but they ignore that part here, I have the right to refuse medical treatment, at least under certain circumstances. They're not trying to undo the Jehovah's Witness thing because they want to be able to overtake you there. And what do you think their reasoning is going to be that is going to enable Quinlan to have her ventilator removed? I'm going to talk about it as if it's her because, again, I'm reminding you, it's not a surrogate case. For Quinlan to have her ventilator removed while she's in a PVS state, but not a Jehovah's Witness to be able to refuse blood products. How would you understand, how do you predict that the court is going to see consistency in a ruling that says both things at the same time?
Whether or not people are acting in their own best interest.
It would be a little bit overstepping the boundaries to say the Jehovah's Witness are all crazy, so we have to make sure that they get blood. So not the best interest, that's a good guess, but it's not where they're going to go. Nope, same thing. Good idea, but nope. The Jehovah's Witness, they're not going to call crazy. Yep.
Does it have to do with the fact that potentially Jehovah's Witness can survive?
Yes. Yes, this is going to turn out to be a sliding scale of survivability and burden. When you have certain types of, and we got a lot of medical folks here too, when you have certain types of conditions where you need a blood transfusion, you could actually be completely salvageable and all you need is some blood. Whereas when you're in a persistent vegetative state, no amount of intervention is going to turn that around, and that is actually the way that they're going to argue this. The state's interest in preserving life, which it has and feels very powerfully in 1975, is going to be trumped by the right to privacy. But it is not always going to be the case that the individual's right to privacy is going to be understood as trumping the state's interest in preserving life of its citizenry. And to refuse blood products is definitely not a good enough reason, by this court's opinion, that your religious persuasion is not a good enough reason to overcome the state's interest in keeping you here for that belief. In 1975, the court uses a sliding scale. As bodily intrusion goes up and prognosis goes down, the state's interest has to also go down. When you have someone in a PVS state, you will not recover, not consciousness, not anything. And so what kind of level of state interest can there be in a body that's being held alive but has no recognizable life as we understand it, not even consciousness? The state's interest, though, in forcing someone against her will to have a blood transfusion goes like this. The bodily intrusion is nothing. It's an IV. The prognosis is extraordinarily good. Let's just assume in the best case scenario, the state's interest is very high in forcing you to have it in 1975. Couldn't have been higher in terms of the bodily invasion. The prognosis couldn't have been worse. No hope of change. Conclusion, her father could exercise her right to privacy. Again, the father is incidental here. It's all about her right to privacy in this case. And this is some of the language that they use. We have no hesitancy in deciding that no external compelling interest of the state could compel Karen to endure the unendurable. We glean that physicians distinguish between curing the ill and comforting and easing the dying, that they refuse to treat the curable as if they were dying, and that they have sometimes refused to treat the hopeless and dying as if they were curable. We think these attitudes represent a balanced implementation of a profoundly realistic perspective on the meaning of life and death, and that they respect the whole Judeo-Christian tradition of regard for human life. Also flagging here the Judeo-Christian bit, because in 1975, we see this in opinion. It'd be interesting to see when we stop seeing Judeo-Christian as one of the anchoring points of decisions at a Supreme Court level of any state. But, you know, what's interesting here is this is not Louisiana. This is New Jersey. So it would be interesting to see when does, you know, I imagine that we might see some differences across states when we start to see this very particular understanding of the tradition and the use of it.
I know you had mentioned that her father was a very devout Catholic. Did the church itself weigh in this case?
I don't think the church. You know, at that point, the church.
Because they.
John has a view, but my understanding is, her priests were with him. They were like all united. But the church, I don't think, had a solidified view. And it's interesting, just in the same way, and then we'll let John in. But the same way with abortion. Abortion becomes a church issue in the late 70s and early 80s. But when Roe versus Wade was passed, I'm not saying they didn't have an opinion, but I'm saying the unified front with the little tiny feet that were passed out at mass and the little roses everybody got as a solidified movement, to me, that was late 70s. And by the time you get Reagan, he's got the religious right totally organized and the bully pulpit, you know, he's got the back of the political backing for the religious right, and that's where you really see momentum with the church and other, not just the church with the capital C, Catholic Church, but the other Protestant churches also. Stephanie?
Oh, I was just going to ask about the sliding scale and then how that actually tracks with Roe, because it seems like under their sliding scale, Roe would not have come down the way it did. Because if you're looking at prognosis, I mean, the prognosis of a woman who is pregnant but doesn't want to.
They used a different sliding scale. The sliding scale was how life is the life. So the sliding scale was it's not too much life until the first trimester ends. Then it's a huge jump to being viable life. So it's a different sliding scale. Go ahead. Second trimester, huge leap from first to second. What? Well, from second to third. But I think even in Roe, isn't it that you can't have a purely elective abortion in the second trimester?
Oh, good. Liability is the only
it goes with it.
It goes up, but the trimester, I mean, Roe is falsely quoted for having a kind of trimester approach.
Okay. And viability is going to shift then, so at that time, it would have been pretty late in the second trimester, right?
It was 26 weeks then, 27 weeks then, instead of 24.
Yeah, well, it's not that big a difference. All righty. For those possibly curable, such devices are of great value, and as ordinary medical procedures are essential. But in light of the situation in the present case, one would have to think that the use of the same respirator or life support could be considered ordinary in the context of the possibly curable patient, but extraordinary in the context of the force sustaining by cardiorespiratory processes of an irreversibly doomed patient. So we start to get the difference between ordinary and extraordinary. Now, what happens broadly in terms of the broader trends, especially for implications in bioethics? In the culture of medicine and medical care, the decisions had actually been in the domain of clinicians and not patients. Right around the late 60s, and especially in the early 70s, we see the birth of the patients' rights movement, of which this is part. There had been a deferential attitude towards clinicians and their best medical judgments. You might think that still exists, but I want to give you a quote here from the trial court where the subtle reverence people may have for clinical opinion isn't subtle at all. It's explicit, and it's named as their right that decisions that get made about patient care are the purview, are the domain of clinicians. That's not something any court, any state, any government, any advocacy organization could say today. The nature of care is the responsibility of a physician. The determination, this is from the trial court, not the Supreme Court. The determination whether Quinlan be removed from the respirator is to be left to the treating physician. As we now know, the conflicts at the bedside are about physicians who tend to want to withdraw and families who don't. And that fight, in that fight, who wins? Families always win. Uniformly, families win. Some hospitals have tried futility policies. They've basically been futile, and there have been very few of them. Patients and patients' families always win.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the clause about under certain circumstances, isn't it possible for somebody to offer a counter-read that says that it's arbitrary and sort of vague?
Which standard?
No, I mean the clause that says under the circumstances.
Under certain circumstances.
Yes, under certain circumstances.
Yeah, that's why they're going to use, all they're going to talk about in this case is my read on it, is the most extreme, okay. PVS, no hope.
Okay.
And I don't, and that, what'd you say?
It's the case in front.
Yeah, so that's it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Quinlan case, though, begins this shift towards patient-centered medical decision. In fact, it was on the news. It was in the newspaper. It was everywhere. It was the first big withdrawal case, and everybody was following it. And it showed how dehumanizing and futile and prolonged this technology could be. So this technology that had been held out as miraculous and life-saving, which it absolutely is, now was being seen as having an underbelly, a seedy side, that you could get on it, but it would not be necessarily that easy to get off of it. And so we began to have conversations about what a dignified death was. Because prior to these agonizing ventilator decisions, there was no machinery that was going to prolong life past the point where one would actually want to be prolonged. And so this is the beginning of these conversations that actually give birth to the advanced directives. And we see the first one in 1976, just 1 year after Quinlan. By 1977, there are seven other states. Eight states within 2 years of Quinlan have advanced directive acts. That's how powerful the Quinlan decision was. And I even remember, I was a young child, but I remember these conversations around the dinner table about this. This was really in people's living rooms. And it had a lot of implication for who gets to make these decisions and what do you want to do. Doesn't mean that everybody got an advance directive, because as you know, advance directives have basically been a colossal failure in terms of having people prior to crisis decide and talk to loved ones. Very few people, even on an ethics committee, you can do a show of hands how many people have one, and almost nobody does. So while it started the conversation and gave families quite a bit of right, it didn't mean that patients talked to their families about what they would want or designated the big decision, the healthcare proxy. There's surrogates, but the healthcare proxy, which forestalls all these debates, very few people actually have. Nevertheless, I just want to point out that literally this is a New Jersey state decision, and it is so it doesn't have nearly the it doesn't have the range when the Supreme Court of the U.S. speaks, which it will in the next case. So it is not technically binding in other states. The states look around. That right? That's my understanding. Yeah. What happened next? Human interest again. Well, the physicians didn't listen. They didn't actually try to withdraw the ventilator. They tried a weaning process, because if they could wean her, then they actually hadn't withdrawn on her, and she would actually survive the weaning. And what's interesting about this is that her father and mother do not want her to survive the withdrawal of the ventilator. That's what withdrawal is. It's the decision that death is to come, not that, oh, I'd love to live, I just don't want to live with that thing in my throat. So what's interesting is that the physicians are really acting in the spirit of what the decision was. Quinlan wants their daughter to move to the next life, which I probably think they think is waiting there with the angels. That's not what the physicians want. They want her to live, so they begin to wean. But 6 weeks post-decision, she still can't get off. So then it's push comes to shove, and they actually remove it. Of course, she does breathe on her own. She wasn't able to be weaned, but they pull the ventilator out, and she spontaneously breathes. And she breathes for 9 years in the fetal position in an institution, and she receives artificial food and hydration. The parents have no interest whatsoever in removing her feeding tube. This is, and again, many people, it's going to be interesting when we get to Cruzan next case, but many people draw a sharp distinction today even between ventilator on the one hand and food and hydration on the other. The Supreme Court negates that distinction. They say there is no distinction. And bioethicists tend to be following Cruzan and the Supreme Court on that, arguing there is no distinction. Nevertheless, many people in their heart of hearts believe there is a significant distinction, including the church. And she dies of pneumonia in 1985. Before we get to Cruzan, I'm going to take us to Bouvet. Because, and if you're in the know, you won't say Bouvier, and you'll want to say Bouvet because she's still alive. Which is interesting, because this is a withdrawal case. This is now a withdrawal case of food and hydration, but not someone in a persistent vegetative state at all. Someone who is absolutely mentally competent. She wants this removed for herself. Now, we know that the cases following Quinlan for ventilators argue that if you want it, you can get rid of it. Now, this is a California case, but nevertheless, by this point, that's the trend. When I'm competent and I want a ventilator out, out it comes. But this is a food and hydration case. And so we're going to see quite a different argumentation that goes around here. And yet the court is ultimately going to side with Bouvet. Elizabeth Bouvet was born with cerebral palsy. By 28, she was quadriplegic. She suffered from degenerative arthritis and she had chronic pain. When she ate, she had nausea and vomiting, so her quality of life was abysmal, in addition to being completely paralyzed. She had had quite a normal, quote-unquote, life. Like, she had had a marriage, she had gone to college, so she was highly educated. She had not always suffered at this extreme level. Absolutely, without question, she was deemed by psychiatrists as mentally competent, and that's why this case actually becomes important for this lineage. What happens is she had to be institutionalized because she could not find anyone who could take care of her at the level she needed care with the quadriplegia and the nausea and all of the rest of it. So she had to be in an institution. And she had decided that she was going to starve herself. And the hospital, against her wishes, despite knowing that she was mentally competent, had forced her to have a feeding tube. And, of course, she's quadriplegic. So she had to succumb and submit to the feeding tube being installed and inserted. The trial court in California says she must have the feeding tube. They will not let her have it removed. She pursues, she fights on, and goes to the Court of Appeals. At the lower level, at the trial court, they said, using the sliding scale of Quinlan, she could live 15, 20 years. This is 1986. And today, it's 2011. She's still alive. They didn't get it wrong. They weren't just, you know, pie in the sky on this one. She actually not only could live long, she did live long, because we're going to have an ironic ending, of course, to this story, just like we're going to have in Cruzan, so we'll get to there. the trial court says, because she has so long to live, the state has an interest in preserving her life, and that outweighs her decision. Reminding ourselves that both Quinlan and Bouvet are about individuals' right to decide about medical treatment. Surrogate is not part of the equation on either, even though obviously Quinlan is truly a surrogate case. It's not understood that way. The Court of Appeals disagreed, and this is how they side for Bouvet. The patient has an exclusive right to refuse any medical treatment or service, anything at all, even if that treatment is life-saving or life-prolonging. This is the decision for California that makes sure no Jehovah's Witness will ever have blood, who's competent, who will ever have blood imposed on them. Because if her situation is dire, I mean, it's not life-threatening. I mean, her quadriplegia means that she could actually live quite a long time. Just needing a blood transfusion is even more minor. This court decision for California says that any patient can decide any refusal of care, no matter what's involved in the stakes, provided the patient is confident. No longer using a sliding scale from the way that Quinlan had been decided, where the decision hinged on prognosis and level of invasion. And there you go. Now, the court can't compel blood transfusions, not even for something as curative as a blood transfusion, you know, so curative. The trial court said, the Superior Court argued that amount of time without quality of life is the wrong distinction to be making. It's not that this court thought it could make the decision about quality of life. It's just trying to critique prior decisions that hung too much on quantity of life rather than quality of life. This court says quality of life and quantity of life aren't the court's business. Privacy, the right to decide your own course of medical treatment, outweighs any interest in the state in a competent patient. And reaffirms what has now gone on for, you know, for more than 10 years, the decisions have to be made by patients, not by physicians. This is not the realm for physician decision making. And it's not even material to the case that she will die when the feeding tube is removed. It doesn't matter. This is a quote from the Cobbs versus Grant case. A person of adult years and in sound mind has the right, in the exercise of control over his own body, to determine whether or not to submit to medical treatment. Extending that, then, the Superior Court in California says, the right to refuse medical treatment is basic and fundamental. It is recognized as part of the right of privacy protected by both the state and federal constitutions. Its exercise requires no one's approval. It is a moral and philosophical decision that, being a competent adult, is hers alone. So though this is a California case, it speaks to a national broadening of Quinlan, an understanding that patients' rights trump the state's interest and are part of this movement of patients making decisions for themselves. Again, not decisions no longer being dependent on quantity of life or bodily invasion, those decisions being one's personal preference from a competent perspective. You know. So what happens? Well, they remove the tube. And they don't do that pussyfooting around that they did in the Quinlan. Out it comes. But she continues to take in a liquid diet. And she starts to get better care and get better pain management, because now her case actually has quite a bit of attention. This is 20 years before palliative care movement is born, so her pain was not being properly addressed. Her quality of life, there were things that could be tried to actually make her quality of life improve. And with the attention she gets in this case, she actually gets some competent clinicians who are very caring, and they help her build a life that she feels is satisfactory. And she's still alive. So it's an odd twist. I'm very happy about it. But it's kind of odd that Bouvet is one of the poster children for patients' rights to decide, you know, what happens with their, and it's an end-of-life case, and it turns out it wasn't the end of her life at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Bouvet could have happened if Quinlan hadn't gone part of the way first?
Probably not, but, you know, that's the question. I don't know. I mean, you do?
California actually was the first thing to really adopt. Mm-hmm. Not to consent.
It's like we could have gotten it in many paths, maybe.
Right, we didn't actually need to get into the Constitution issues. I mean, I was actually surprised that it had to be done like that with the first place. Mm-hmm. Because there is this common law right to consent and not consent. If you don't give consent, that means you're refusing. Mm-hmm. Absolute right to refuse.
Right.
And it's actually interesting. So you mentioned this. The technology didn't want to dominate this.
No, please, dominate.
But it was technology. If you look at the flow of the cases, because the cases flowed from consent in the 1800s in medical situations where there was absolute right to refuse. Mm-hmm. And as technology advanced, it went through a couple of perturbations. One involved cases involving children. So children were, you know, physicians kind of imposed, they have some kind of medical care for a kid, and the kid and the parents try to refuse it. They can't refuse it because the state imposes, and it's the 19th century, the 20th century was the century of the child. I mean, so the state was extremely protective of children, so the courts basically said, you can't kill your child. You know, we're not going to allow you to refuse general care for your children. But there are cases that they're allowing people to refuse for themselves. But then the technology kept away, and as technology improved, mm-hmm. doctors were more sure that their intervention could actually accomplish something. Mm-hmm. They went to the courts. They were like, this person can't refuse this because it's going to prevent serious bodily harm. They want to take off a leg. You know, it's gangrenous. We're going to take a leg off and save this person. Mm-hmm. And they're refusing. Mm-hmm. And they're not, you know, they're competent, but, you know, they really believe they're competent. Who wants to die, right? So the courts get into this second guessing. Mm-hmm. And it happened in all these areas, especially involving kind of vulnerable people, old people, babies, fetuses. I mean, how many cases did we have in the 70s and 80s taking fetuses from women by C-section, you know, because the doctors went to court to get orders and calling the C-section. Right? That doesn't happen too much anymore, but there's a major fundamental change. But so technology did impose in a very mm-hmm. important way. Mm-hmm. It took us kind of like a bit of time. It was this bubble. It mm-hmm. took us a bit of time to get past that and get back to the common law. So, mm.
That's, yeah, that's really interesting.
I do think that Quinlan case was unfortunate because they raised the constitutional issue, so the court had to dispose of it that way. Mm-hmm. But it was
interesting.
But you could have argued that with the Griswold, whatever that case is, also the common law. They could have gone down the common law path as well on that one.
Perhaps there was state action. The state banned, since the 1800s, the state banned contraception sales. So it was a real state action.
But couldn't they have argued on common law grounds also?
Privacy?
Yeah.
I don't know. Actually, in 2 weeks, ask Dr. Brown.
Great. Okay. Oh. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess in 601 we talk about end of life issues, and I just wonder in, you know, this case, I don't know that it's universally applicable, but it represents, I think, my worst nightmare with end of life issues. Like, was it really the case that her quality of life was so bad, or was it an access issue?
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder how this applies to the common person. So someone whose case isn't in the media, and someone, you know, who isn't going to get attention from the best physicians in the country.
Right.
I mean, do you really follow the example of
right.
this woman?
Right. No, it's a great ethics issue, probably more than a legal issue, of when we allow people to decide their own course, which is great, do we provide them everything they need to have all the available options and choose from all the available options? So that if someone who is upper middle class, has great health insurance, has access to the best doctor, says, my quality of life is not good enough, I want this feeding tube removed. That may not, I have the exact same right as someone who may not have good health insurance, may not be getting proper attention, may not have the best clinicians. We have the same right. But I am choosing from the benefit of having every possible option available to me and choosing from that perspective of privilege and access. And the other person may not be choosing from privilege and access, but from desperation and lack of care. And that inequality is not something I think the law can solve, but it is something bioethics has to be worried about. And it's the same thing that rears its head when we talk about physician-assisted suicide, because the highly educated with complete access to all good palliative care and hospice are making a decision based on lots of options that may actually not be options when you are coerced by your finances, which doesn't mean I have more right to decide than they have, but it does make us worry that their decision might have a coercive element to it and mine might not. So the law probably, it can't probably see that, but ethics certainly can.
And people really do refuse life-saving, life-preserving kind of technologies. And they also have changing preferences, and we see that in the PAS cases, and we see it in the end-of-life stuff. And mm-hmm. well, I won't get into it, but you think people clearly will make their choices, and then the choices will change.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually, a very good friend of mine died to get ELS. He had ELS for 9 years, and when he was, before he was intubated, he was like, you know, I'm facing this decision. I may not do it. And he wound up doing it. Not only did he wind up doing it, but as his condition, as he kind of like degraded into this total dependence on a ventilator, tube feeding and everything else, he wanted to live. He wanted to live until his, until whatever happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And another kind of brother actually got ALS, and did not, I think he refused to be intubated.
Yeah, I think the finality is just creepy.
Right.
Because, I mean, say she didn't have that care, I mean, would we be reading articles that say, you know, we probably could have helped her, you know,
right.
Maybe, and she's gone.
Right. Actually, if we hadn't helped her, we wouldn't have known that there was any help she still needed. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because she thought she actually had everything that she needed to make this decision, when in fact, when more was offered to her, she made a different decision. Okay, I'm going to turn us now, in the interest of time, to Cruzan, which is sort of like the drum roll, you know, cymbals clanging case for withdrawal, because it is a surrogate case. It is a Supreme Court case. It governs then, of course, through for every state. And it is not just a ventilator case. It is actually not a ventilator case at all. It's food and hydration. And it, from the court's view, removes the distinction between ventilator and food and hydration once and for all at the legal level. It has an interesting twist, too. But let's talk about just the plain facts. January 11th, 1983, Nancy Cruzan lost control of her car. Paramedics did restore her breathing and her heartbeat, but she was without oxygen for 12 to 14 minutes. She entered a PVS state. She had motor reflexes, but no cognitive function. Now, she's basically Schiavo. She needs food and hydration, but she can breathe. But in terms of cognition, she is PVS and is never coming out of it. Cruzan's parents, again, driving this, still 1990, they want the hospital to have her feeding tube removed, and the hospital says no. The trial court sides with the parents and says she can have her feeding tube removed, and they argue that the Constitution grants the right to refuse death prolonging procedures, and they argue food and hydration is death prolonging. Supreme Court of Missouri, though, reverses the decision, and that's how it gets kicked to the Supreme Court. The U.S. The Supreme Court of Missouri says that the Constitution doesn't support the right of a person to refuse medical treatment in every circumstance. Again, we see the Quinlan argument. But more importantly, for what happens at the Supreme Court level, Missouri says that they can have a burden, a bar, of clear and convincing evidence in a surrogate case. That's what Nancy would have wanted. And there are a few states that have the clear and convincing evidence bar. And so when it goes to the Supreme Court, part of the interest, I imagine, and you can speak to this, is the food and hydration bit. But it's the state's claim that it is allowed to have a clear and convincing bar. That's where they're going to put the bar. And is that permissible? Can the state decide that that's where they want their bar, even if there is a right to refuse medical treatment? Are you okay with me?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so this is heard by the Supreme Court in 1990. The court says that the Missouri Supreme, it affirms the Supreme, here's the weird part. It affirms the Missouri Supreme Court's claim that there can be this high evidentiary bar, that a state can say, I want to have clear and compelling evidence in a surrogate case that that's what you would have wanted, that that's what the patient would have wanted. I can hold that bar, and I am not violating the 14th Amendment and your right to refuse medical treatment if I asked, if I want to make damn sure that is what you want. And so the Supreme Court actually sides against Cruzan's family and says no withdrawing of the tube. That's the ironic part of this decision, and of course there has to be more to it or we wouldn't be talking here. But what I want to just emphasize is that the Supreme Court's argument was, we have a high bar in Missouri before we start taking away life-supporting care. We want to know that's what a patient would want. So we're going to hold that standard, and we don't think that is a burden to patients' rights. And the Supreme Court says, that's a state's decision how high you want the bar. You're allowed to have that bar. You're allowed to know that that's what a patient would want. That said, the court goes on to say, when we know that is what you want, we can't make any artificial distinction between ventilator and food and hydration. So let's assume that Nancy would have wanted no food and hydration. That is no different than Nancy not wanting a ventilator. Food, hydration, ventilator, they're all the same thing, which I, as the Supreme Court, am not judging in the Cruzan case. That's a state decision about how much evidence you have of whether that's what Nancy would want. And you have to decide if the surrogates and the evidence meets that bar. But should it meet that bar, you can't make a distinction between hydration and food and ventilator. And so it actually gets kicked back to Missouri. The final word is only food and hydration and nutrition. Food, hydration, and ventilator can't be distinguished. Now go back and decide, is there clear and convincing evidence? So it gets kicked back to Missouri. Cruzan's family do not win at the Supreme Court level. Story's going to go on, obviously. But the implications for us in bioethics are actually tremendous, because now there is no distinction between food and hydration and ventilator. The court says, the principle that a competent person has a constitutionally protected liberty interest in refusing unwanted medical care may be inferred from our prior decisions. Unwanted medical care, absolutely you can refuse. The Constitution would grant a competent person a constitutionally protected right to refuse life-saving hydration and nutrition. If you are competent, which she's not, absolutely you could refuse hydration and nutrition. That is part of unwanted medical care. The right to be free from medical attention without consent to determine what shall be done with one's own body is deeply rooted in this nation's traditions. No material distinction can be drawn between the treatment to which Nancy Cruzan continues to be subject, artificial nutrition and hydration, and any other medical treatment. Artificial delivery of food and water is regarded as medical treatment by the medical profession. When a person is unconscious, both a respirator and an artificial feeding device serve to support or replace normal bodily functions. This ruling now applies to all states, grants everyone the right to refuse treatment, even if it's life-saving. No distinction now between ventilator and nutrition and hydration. So what happens next? Well, funny, it goes back to the hands of the trial court, and somehow there are just all kinds of people who knew that, yes, she absolutely said, you know, at the sorority house and every other place, that if she was ever in a PBS state and having food and hydration, she absolutely would not want food and hydration. So they're able to have other witnesses come forward, the publicity of the case, and the trial court decides clear and convincing evidence has been met. And the hospital yields. And so the feeding tube is removed and she dies in December. Wow, they have a big state's interest. Jeez.
Think about the implications of this case. It's actually really scary. So they're basically thinking, we own this woman, you don't, you're a family.
It's amazing.
But from an ethics perspective, the other thing is, if you look at the ethics, and this is an interesting contrast between law and ethics and bioethics, is from an ethics perspective, what do we ask when we're saying, let's make a decision? We have a surrogate who's going to make a decision for someone else. We don't say that they have to do, they always have to do what the person said they would want. We also have what's called the best interest analysis. What is the best interest of this person to do? It applies most of the time when that person has not really had an opportunity to express what their interests were. Here's a young woman. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she did. Maybe she didn't. Who knows? But, you know, if it was a younger person, in fact, it was a child, they wouldn't even look to this. It would have been an interesting case. And I don't know if the courts have weighed in on this.
Mm-hmm.
But the legal standard here is not open to a best interest analysis.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. If this hadn't been controversial, the surrogates would have just decided what they thought was best, and that's what would have been done, and then we would have been not.
Plus, we know that from the literature about advanced directives, is that when you ask surrogates, if you ask surrogates, surrogates and you ask the patient, you know, the people they're in charge of, you ask them what their preferences are, surrogates choose what they would want to have done. And even though they're supposed to be trying to guess what the other person wants, they're really not grounded. There's no real basis for them to make a decision like that. So they say, they don't know that they're doing that. I mean, they're really trying to guess what the other person would do.
Right. So. Great. Okay, so now I'm going to take you to Wendland versus Wendland, the last case I'm going to consider tonight about withdrawal of care, because now we have left the arena of the PVS, where we were talking about surrogates. We're now going to be in a surrogate case, but now we're not anywhere near PVS. And the Wendland versus Wendland here is Wendland the wife and Wendland the mother and sister in Wendland versus Wendland. In September 1993, Robert Wendland was in a serious auto accident. He's in a coma, but he regained consciousness. So he started out in a coma, but he did regain consciousness. But he is severely disabled mentally and physically. He's certainly not competent. They do take care of him devotedly for several years, but he makes no progress. And the wife and his daughters believe that he would not want to live like this. And so they want his feeding tube removed. So it is now a feeding tube case, but he is not in a persistent vegetative state. And he is not terminal. He's conscious, and he is not terminal. His mother and his sister opposed the withdrawal. If they had all been on the same page, my guess is the hospital wouldn't have said anything. It's conflicts between surrogates or conflicts between providers and surrogates that get us into these legal hassles or even conflicts in the hospital. If everybody had been on the same side, and there probably have been many, many of those kind of cases, we wouldn't hear about it. But the question is, can the wife now make that decision in opposition to what the mother thinks? Because in most states, I'm sure most of you know this, but each state has a pecking order short of someone being designated as the healthcare proxy, which can't be vetoed no matter where you are in the pecking order. That's the legal document that is the health power of attorney. So if I don't trust my husband, I can give that to my best friend. And just by the fact that my husband is my husband, he's totally vetoed by the fact that I've given somebody else power of attorney for my health care, which is the health care proxy. But short of that kind of institution designation of who should decide for me, there is a pecking order in each state. And it is almost always that it is your spouse that comes next. And then it depends on the state and what the situation is if you have adult children. But then it can, where parents come in when there is also adult children, can vary. But my guess is it's typically spouse, adult children, parents, siblings, typically. So we have two top-tier decision makers against two lower-tier decision makers. So the first surrogate and the second surrogate in a pecking order are on one side, get rid of the tube, the mother and sister on another. Think about the Schiavo case, same thing. You have her husband as the top surrogate maker, and actually that's what rules the day, but she's in a PVS state. And the parents, who would be the next in line because she had no children, they get vetoed by the top of the ticket surrogate. But this is not a terminal case. So the trial court applies the clear and convincing evidence standard and blocks the wife's petition. The court overturns the trial court's decision. This is California. The Supreme Court of California overturns the Court of Appeals, siding with the trial court. Their argument is that the patient is not terminally ill, not in a PVS state, not comatose, so actually awake, has no healthcare proxy, and left no written instructions. That no healthcare proxy is important, and maybe I've already implied why. Having a surrogate who's just in the pecking order, like my husband with no designation, I've written an advance directive, big deal, my husband is the one who would make decisions for me. That doesn't have the same standing as if I have healthcare power of attorney given to someone, if I've given healthcare proxy. Because if I've given healthcare proxy to someone, and I actually have that as a legal document that has been signed by a lawyer, which I do and I advocate that you do too, then when that person speaks as if it's coming right out of your mouth. So that is, it would be as if this man is saying, take that tube out. If his wife had healthcare proxy and said, tube out, the only way the court would have any interest in trumping what she said is if they wanted to find that she actually had somehow reneged on her responsibility, that she was illegitimate in some way. But that's a huge fight. So it is not easy to overturn a healthcare proxy at all. That's the patient's voice speaking through someone else. It has that legal standing. Just like with regular power of attorney, when they write checks, that's like you writing them. Surrogates have a much lower standing, and you have two surrogates duking it out. So, various surrogates are disagreeing. No healthcare proxy. Under the circumstances, this is what the court says. The surrogate may not withhold artificial nutrition and hydration absent clear and convincing evidence. The conservator's decision is in accordance with either the conservatee's own wishes or best interest. If the surrogate, the wife and the daughters, had something, some evidence that would rise to the level of clear and convincing, not just their own personal views, but something like, oh my God, if I can't teach a philosophy class, or I can't run a marathon, don't let me be on a feeding tube, or I don't know what, you know, something written, something said, some kind of evidence that would be understood by the court as clear and compelling. Short of that, the surrogates can't just withdraw food and hydration, says this court decision. Again, not the same thing. If he had had healthcare proxy, he'd be dead. But for now, but in this case, without any clear and compelling evidence, short of having a healthcare proxy, the court is not going to take the risk that maybe the surrogate doesn't know. The mom says he wants to live. The wife says he doesn't. He could live for a long, long time. In fact, he's still living. The court is not going to side with one surrogate over another without the clear and compelling evidentiary bar being met. The court wants to be very clear, though. It is not trying to muck around with patients who are comatose at the minimal, terminally ill, PVS. It's not trying to get in and make a decision about any of those circumstances. It's talking about conscious patients. Now, that may be a fine line, but at least the court is acting with a little bit of trepidation. They're trying not to step on any of those. Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting why they're trying. Excellent question. I mean, I think that they've made a value judgment that being in a PVS state has no quality of life, whereas being conscious and, you know, babbling is okay. Is some kind that some people would call that a quality life. But it's a value judgment. I don't think there's any way around seeing that the court has decided. I wouldn't want to be in a PVS state, but I can imagine some people liking to go blah, 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 drool all day watching Sesame Street. I don't know, because it seems like an obvious value judgment to me. Obviously, since the Schindlers thought that being in a PVS state was great.
I mean, I do think that there's a definite distinction that there. I mean, just because when you, being a physician, when I take care of patients who are not comatose, but certainly not competent, there is such a variety of their experience of life where you can't really point to something, whereas PVS, 100% of them are not enjoying what's going on because they're not experiencing anything, whereas they're, you know, again, you get to this fine scale. There's some, I have plenty of patients who are not competent, you know, who can have a conversation with you. You just have no idea what they're saying. But they can.
Or they might like the taste of food.
Or
they might like something visual. Right, exactly.
So I think that it would be tougher to draw that line, I would just say, from a legal standpoint.
Right. Right, and you can imagine somebody who is awake and can use, let's say, the sense of taste, so likes to eat. And the mom says, that's good enough, and the wife says, oh my God, do you know what this guy used to be like? He was a philosopher or whatever. But that's a value judgment that is going to be hard to adjudicate without knowing what the guy thought about that existence. So that's sure part of it. We emphasize, however, that the clear and convincing standard does not apply to the vast majority of healthcare decisions made by conservators under Section 23550. That's the only quote we've got. So they are trying to say that they're not trying to make a broad statement here, but in this gray area of conscious, they want to know, what did you want? My guess is this court would have taken fairly had fairly wide latitude if there was something you could cough up. But the problem is when you get into these circumstances, there's just not a lot. And I know a lot of you have heard me say this, but I say it every class to make sure there's plenty of people who come forward. I don't want to live like this. So you just come and get the tube right out of me, because you never, you know, I mean, there'll be people out of the woodwork. But Wendland would surely not have had the opportunity to be saying that to his friends at a bar, which is why the Nancy Cruzan thing that, oh, yeah, a lot of people knew that she had said that. Really, she was 22-year-old sorority, you know, student. That's what she was saying. That just, unfortunately, we just don't say these kind of things unless we're in the front of the classroom talking about how we don't want to be on a feeding tube like this. Okay, that's the end of life withdrawal cases for my talk tonight. I'm going to move to PAS unless there's last minute things to think about and ask about. I am. Yes, you can. You can have three. Knock yourself out.
Was an amazing statement for the court to make, because that basically said nobody can die in this state if you're complaining about it. You know, one action would hold their care. It's like you can only do it with the court and with the judge. And everybody can like throw up their arms, and it took a very short period of time before the court corrected.
I'm sure, and they were overloaded. They're like, look, like this.
It was a ridiculous statement from the bank, and then kind of corrected the course. But you do wind up with this stuff, and these judges kind of get imposed into these circumstances. There's places where, you know, these cases are oftentimes the judges go to the hospital and they meet with the family, and they're very kind of like, and they're imposing in some way, they're imposing their values. And I'm actually surprised that it quotes them all, how much value matters. You know, the idea that, well, this life is worth living, this one's not. And they're basically imposing, and it's really, I mean, it's outcome determinative, I'm not a critic here, but it's just like,
right.
It's like they're really.
Right. And that actually is going to be a nice segue into the PAS cases, because this is exactly what the philosopher's brief, which is what it's called, the amicus brief that's written for the Glucksberg case, is going to accuse the court of doing. That on physician-assisted suicide, they're going to accuse them of having snuck in their own view about suicide and not actually looked at the due process or the equal protection clause, which is what they're supposed to decide on. So we're going to see if that's true. But that is certainly what the philosophers in the philosopher's brief argue in the most famous amicus brief that happens surrounding these two famous cases of PAS. These two cases that I'm now talking about, the one that we get the amicus brief for, are heard by the Supreme Court at the same time. One comes up through one circuit, and one comes up through another circuit. But they are similar in structure, though it's going to turn out to be the case that the 14th Amendment is going to be at issue in both different sections of the 14th Amendment. It's very, very short passage that's at issue, but one is going to care about the due process clause and one is going to care about the equal protection clause. The Supreme Court's going to see them together, and you already know they're going to argue there is no federal right to physician-assisted suicide. That's a state matter. They don't argue that states can't decide. They argue, in fact, states must decide. It's only for states, and that's why since 1997 we'd already had Oregon by the time this case is heard, and since then we had Washington and Montana. So we have three states, two states prior, post this decision, because, of course, they opened the door for states or even the legislature of the U.S. government to make a ruling that makes it law. But it, but their decision is it's not in the Constitution. So that's what we're going to hear. In Quill, and by the way, you probably know this, but the Quill of Quill versus Vacco is Timothy Quill. Timothy Quill, who became quite well known for his advocacy of physician-assisted suicide, though when we launched our colloquium series 4 years ago, he was the keynote speaker, the launch, the inaugural address, and he is going down, he's down the palliative care path now. He does not talk about PAS at all. He's very much about palliative care. He's very much a proponent of what used to be called terminal sedation is now called palliative sedation. It's much more palatable to call it palliative sedation. He doesn't talk much about PAS anymore. He's certainly not leading the fight in the state of New York. But it is the lawsuit of Quill versus the Attorney General at the time of the state of New York, Vacco. And the other one is the state of Washington versus Glucksberg. So in Quill, the question is, does New York's prohibition against PAS violate one part of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause? I'm going to go through both of these. The Glucksberg case is, does Washington's prohibition against PAS violate the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, where we dig out the privacy rights? And we'll talk about those. Heard by the Supreme Court at the same time. Okay, first, Quill. The Second Circuit ruled that denying patients PAS violated an equal protection guarantee because in New York, you can allow residents, patients, to refuse life support. And there is a justice claim being made that, which I'll elaborate on, that you are not treating like cases like, because some people are able to refuse to have their life prolonged and others are not. Well, here's how it goes. I want to take us, and some of you I know have already read this paper, which is a classic now in bioethics, by James Rachels. It was from NEJM, and it's called Active and Passive Euthanasia. Absolutely, the courts know this argument, because it's almost like especially when the philosophers in the philosopher's brief write the amicus brief, they're basically direct quoting off of Rachels' argument here. But the justice argument, the equal protection argument, was originally made, or at least famously made, by Rachels. And this is what he argues. He doesn't want us to talk about withdrawal of care on the one hand and physician-assisted suicide on the other, that is, taking some kind of barbiturates to end your life, which looks like suicide. He wants to talk about the choice of hastening your own death, the ability to employ medical means to hasten your death. That's what he wants us, how he wants us to define these two moments, withdrawal on the one hand and PAS on another. And what he's arguing is that it's not just to let some people hasten death just because, and others not, just because some have the wrong disease. What does it mean? Well, if a patient doesn't have the right kind of disease with the right kind of treatment, and there's a little bit of an irony here, and it's very dark, you know, here to talk this way, but a patient can't choose time and manner of death, and the surrogate can't choose it for you. But if you do have the right kind of disease and the right kind of treatment, they absolutely can. So if you happen to have, tragically, ALS and you have a ventilator, you can actually say, I now want to choose the time and manner of my death. Please withdraw this. I have the right disease for where we are legally in terms of medical care. I can refuse this treatment. I can say, take it out because I've got ALS. But if I've got cancer and I don't have a feeding tube or a ventilator, I have to endure until the very last minute, until the disease overtakes me, because I got the wrong kind of disease, given how our mores are speaking to us about what our patients' rights are. But the argument about equal protection is like cases have to be treated as like. Terminal ill, using medical help, not using medical help, not treating like cases like, deciding whether time and manner of death can be decided based on having certain types of terminal illness rather than terminal illness per se. That's the justice argument. It's not fair, not just that some people get a privilege that others don't have by the luck of the draw of what disease you actually get. That's what Rachel's argued. You're going to see this mirrored here in Quill. But the court says, the Supreme Court says, the 14th Amendment isn't violated by the prohibition. Oh, I, and now it's the, it, let, let me, I look like I'm going to talk about them two of them together. Let me see. The other argument is that I have a right to suicide, and as we get through the cases, we'll talk about that too. It looks like I'm summarizing here, but we'll go through each one. Okay. For the Quill argument, the Second Circuit ruled that denying patients PAS violated the equal protection guarantee because it allowed some people to refuse death prolonging treatment. The Second Circuit says the Supreme Court is wrong in claiming that some terminally ill people are treated differently from others because hastening death by ending treatment and hastening death by PAS aren't actually the same thing. There's enough distinction there that the fact that you have two terminal illnesses isn't what makes the cases identical. What makes them distinct is that you have two different actions on the part of clinicians, and those two different actions they can rightfully distinguish without being unjust and without treating truly unlike cases as, you know, they're not like cases, so they are unlike cases, so they are treating unlike cases unlike. And the distinction that the court wants to argue is that there is a difference between causation and intent. Now, when you read the rest of the Rachel's paper, you will see that he passionately denies that causation and intent actually matter when it comes to PAS, and we can talk a little bit about why, but this is what the court argues on causation first. When a patient refuses life-sustaining medical treatment, he dies from the underlying fatal disease. But if a patient ingests legal medication prescribed by a physician, he's killed by that medication. So the causation of life ending is distinct. One, because you are taking something that isn't supposed to be there and the disease is doing the work. And another, that you're putting something in and the disease is actually not the causal agent of your death, but that thing which you're ingesting, that addition to your body. And that distinction in causation means that you're not talking about like cases. And on intent, on the causation argument, let me just say that philosophically, you can't argue that they are the same causal path. They are obviously not the same causal path. What a philosopher would do and what the philosophers in the amicus brief argue is the causal path isn't relevant. Many times you will have different causal paths, but the question is, how important is the causal path? So you could take a bike to get to school, you could take a train to get to school, but the fact is you both got to school. Does it matter what the causal path was? Philosophers who are pro-PAS are going to argue that causal chain isn't particularly helpful in understanding what the moral distinction is. It's a trivial and unhelpful. Now, you can imagine where this is going to go, and we will talk about why the causation does have another element to it, another layer on it, and that is about the causal agent who's participating in the causal pathway, and that's probably more of the rub, because, of course, the distinction that's going to be made for many people in their minds, in their conscience, is going to be that in the one case when you withdraw, you are actually omitting something. You are taking something away, but you are not acting, and in the other case, you are acting. Though, you know, philosophers are going to say that if you have your hands on the tube that is letting somebody breathe and you pull it out, it's hard to see that that's not an action. It looks like an action. So maybe the omission-action distinction, which is what everyone hinges this on, isn't actually as powerful as it may be led to believe. But let's look at intent for a second first. So we have both of them on the table. A physician who withdraws or honors a patient's refusal to begin life-sustaining medical treatment purposefully intends only to respect his patient's wishes and to cease doing useless or futile or degrading things to the patient. A doctor who assists in suicide, however, must necessarily and indubitably intend primarily that the patient be made dead. Let's think about this. The claim here is that when I withdraw life support, all I'm trying to do is respect what you want. I'm not trying to make you dead. I'm just trying to respect what you want. But when I give you the pill, I'm saying I'd like you to be dead. I find this to be hopelessly impossible to make good on. If you think about, and this is 1997, so we've already had the sea change at the bedside. Let's review. When you have a conflict now at the bedside about withdrawal of care, you almost universally have physicians who want withdrawal and patients who don't. We usually don't have conflict. We're usually all on the same side. But when we have conflict, physicians want the tube out and the family want the tube in. The physicians are just trying to do what the patient wants. What do you mean? In a conflict now, they're trying to do exactly what the surrogate says the patient doesn't want. What are they trying to do? Make the patient dead. They are arguing this patient is futile. Nothing can be done. This patient shouldn't be in the ICU. This patient should be dead. It's hard to say. I think it's not even close to plausible to argue that the intention in withdrawal isn't to make the person dead. They may have a good argument on causation, we'll see. But on intent, I think that it's patently false, that a clinician only wants to adhere to your wishes when they have withdrawal, but when they give you the pills, they want you dead. Most physicians who give you the pills hope that you actually won't take them. They don't want you dead in either case. But if they want you dead in any case, they would rather have you dead and off the ICU unit than to have you in your home and taking pills where you're not actually costing the society any resources. So I find the intent argument to be actually very spurious.
Well, based on like the case you've already talked about where they did withdraw treatments and then normal functioning resumed again, couldn't the intent be to see if the person dies or not?
So I am not saying that it is never the case that a physician against her will withdraw, hoping the person breathes. Back in the day, when it was patients and families who drove the withdrawal and physicians who didn't want the withdrawal to happen, of course, there was a lot of finger crossing.
Yeah.
But I find it hard to believe that you've got a lot of MICU attendings and nurses standing there with their fingers crossing, going, breathe, breathe, right after they have gone hours and hours trying to convince the family to get the tube out and let the person die in peace. It just doesn't. Are there some physicians who hate withdrawal and are always hoping the person breathes so it's not them who are part of the causal mechanism? Sure. Is that typical? It just sounds completely implausible to me. Yes, so that you are not causing them any distress from air hunger, you've got the morphine ratcheted up. Exactly. And when you ratcheted the morphine up, you're actually ratcheting it up, whereas when you give them the pills, most people in Oregon actually don't even take the pills. So your causal connection to the person's death in a withdrawal is very immediate, whereas your causal connection to the person taking the pills in a PAS case is at least once removed and is often the case not even part of why they die, because they actually don't take the pills. They pocket them, they hold them close, and they never actually take them. So the whole thing about causation and intent is very murky. I find the intent weaker than causation, but even the causation, you got your hands on the guy's, you know, tube, and you're ratcheting up the morphine, but, you know, that's not causal mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Is there a distinction made between withdrawal and withholding? So if I don't give treatment as a physician, is that PAS?
You know, it's interesting. No. But I remember an orthodoxy that was the first, when I first came into bioethics, and I was team teaching a course called Death and Dying with someone, a nurse, and she came in and gave us an orthodoxy, wrote it on the board. There is no distinction between withdrawing and withholding. And as a philosopher new to bioethics, I was like, you know, that seemed like to her a truism that didn't seem like logical truism, like Autumn is here or she is not here. I mean, it didn't seem that obvious to me. It seemed to me that there could be a moral distinction between taking something away and never being part of it getting started. But the received view, which is not necessarily the right view, but the received view in bioethics is that there is no distinction. I'm not saying there isn't, I'm saying it's the received view. But no one thinks that's akin to PAS. Because the idea of PAS is that you are giving something that will kill someone, as opposed to not giving something that will help someone or taking something away that was helping someone. The idea is supposed to be that you are actually now the participant in the person's death rather than someone standing by and not preventing. You are actively pushing. And that is the act-omission distinction, which I think is actually fairly spurious, too, on examination. I know you had a question, and then over to you.
I was just going to say, I think that definitely in terms of, I don't know about it sounds like bioethics agrees with medicine. There's absolutely no distinction, and when if we talk to a family, that's kind of how we will always present it, because there's a lot of guilt around, oh, well, let's try the ventilator for, you know, X number of days or weeks, and then if it doesn't work, then clearly we're progressing a little bit more to futile, and that can speak as to the prognosis, and then, but a lot of families want to get into the situation of saying, well, then I can't withdraw it, because that feels very different than if I never started, so they're in this very difficult position of saying, well, do I try it, but then I can't withdraw, so I think that that's useful sometimes in those discussions. I think you had brought up the kind of double effect of morphine, which interestingly, I just wanted to mention, they are increasingly thinking that there is, it's a little bit voodoo, more voodoo than we had thought, and they've actually shown studies that these folks don't actually die any sooner. I have to look at this study somewhere.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
The control group, you know, for that
right.
one.
Wow.
But yeah, which I had always thought was, and when I was going through med school and residency, that was certainly like the, okay, you know, now it's the morphine where we're going to, we might end their life early versus the morphine where you're not going to. But really, it sounds like these folks are so end stage that they can't really even detect any difference between those morphine doses. So, although I guess we're theoretically okay with it because of that principle of double effect, that you're, you know, relieving the pain and suffering, so you're okay with kind of the side effect of death. But it seems like that isn't even really an issue anymore. So.
Interesting.
If that changes anything, but
okay.
It's kind of interesting when I was reading.
I want to follow up on the second point. It's really interesting. I want to follow up on the first point, and that's that you know, this co-teacher had written this thing up as an orthodoxy. I think it's written up as an orthodoxy because many people don't believe it. Mm-hmm. In other words, for whatever reason, whether they're right or they're wrong, many people, many patients and families do not think that it is the same thing. Bioethics does, medicine does, but patients and families often do not think that to take something out is the same thing as never getting started. And there's got to be something they're trying to say to us. So whenever we have an orthodoxy, we probably should, you know, double back and rethink. But it is true that it has to be said like a mantra to families because they actually don't think it's true sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to say that a lot of physicians are also bound by the Hippocratic Oath. So it seems like the courts don't consider that.
They do, actually. You're right. This is actually where it's going to go. The whole idea is that the do no harm principle is supposed to argue against PAS, and certainly euthanasia, in a way that it doesn't, it has no resonance and relevance to withdrawing. Though, when somebody's breathing because of something that I've put in and I take it out, it does seem a little bit hocus pocus that we said, well, that's not doing any harm, but if I give them some prescription, I am doing harm. In what sense are you not doing harm when you've now enabled them to suffocate? But we have decided that that's not harming and that giving a prescription is harming. But it's a funny way how we decide when the Hippocratic Oath is actually governing, what its domain is. In other words, all I'm trying to say is we could easily redefine withdrawal of care as causing harm because what we cause is somebody's death, and we're trying to cause their death because we want them off the unit, and we believe that they're suffering. I mean, it's benevolently motivated. But it's interesting when you add it, when you offer up the Hippocratic Oath as if it will give clarity, I think we've already decided which way we're going to go, and then we say the Hippocratic Oath anchors us. I think there's at least good reasons to argue that the Hippocratic Oath could go the other way.
You described the shift in that 30-year period between the families and then the doctors now saying like they're increasingly willing to withdraw or withhold. Can you just touch a little bit on that? Does it stem from economic concerns and maybe overextended physicians, and that's why they're just, you know, they just, okay, I'll move to the next patient. This is kind of a futile loss power thing, or where did that shift come from?
Right. I bet there's a lot of people who could speak to that more authoritatively than I can, but I'll give you my two cents and we'll see what other people want to add. When the technology was new, we were not inundated with its use. We did not have people clamoring to get into the beds and a lot of competition for the resource because it was new and it was like, let's do it. All right. But now everybody wants it. Everybody gets it. It's standard of care. It's not extraordinary in the sense of unusual the way some experimental laser treatments might be down the block. It's everywhere. It's in Princeton, for heaven's sake, and Holy Redeemer, outside community hospitals. Everybody's got the ventilators. But now we can do so well keeping people on the ventilators that they stay on the ventilators over and over and over again. And physicians have to watch patients just stay at death's door. And I remember rounding when I first got the job, and the chief resident had to give the report, and we were all traveling around, and the resident opened up with, "The patient is stable." And I thought, this is great. The patient is stable at death's door, where she had been for 6 months. Organs failing one after another. Stable, yes. Stable right at the end. That gets very upsetting day after day, especially when the resources, not just the economic resources, physicians often talk about that, and I think some of them really are burdened by it. But I think there's another whole level of burden. The burden of spending all of your Marxian level labor, you know, your Marxian understood labor that you are putting into this and getting nothing in return. A body that is, in your view, basically dead. You are unconscious. You are not going nowhere. You're just falling apart piece after piece after piece. Nobody is getting any closure. You're not getting any closure. And you're actually putting your labor, and not just you as a, you know, the nurse, the physician, the respiratory tech, everyone pouring labor into a body that's basically dead. I think all of that has helped with the shift of this. So futility is not just an economic problem. It's a burden for the resource of one's labor and time and energy and concern, I think. Adding to that, anyone?
Well, I was just wondering, the one thing that, people haven't really thrown out here is the issue about voluntariness. So voluntariness, and it might be, in law, actually might be leading the way in a sense that why these things are different, why withdrawal and COVID are different, because it's still in bodily invasion at the moment, and you have right to refuse it. And refusing means that to continue it over someone's refusal is still up and down to battery. Basically provides a remedy for this bodily invasion, even if it is life-saving. So somebody has, in the law, there's no distinction. You can impose it on somebody who has refused it, or you keep going after they refuse it. The same thing.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that as an explanation for why the orthodoxy exists. It's on the battery end, the patient's body focus, whereas the puzzle comes, I think, from the decision makers and their responsibility about what's going to happen causally to their loved one, and that's where it probably feels very different.
The physical act.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you stand back, and you're
going to... Exactly. Dirty hands problem, you say. Okay, moving on to Glucksberg, the Ninth Circuit now. So we were on the Second Circuit in New York. We're now on the Ninth Circuit in Glucksberg, rules that there is a liberty interest in choosing time and manner of death that is anchored by the due process clause in the 14th Amendment. And for this, I want to take us to the philosopher's brief that I have been mentioning. This is the amicus brief that was written for the Vacco case, but it's got the same mechanism. And it argues against the lower courts that there is a right in the U.S. to control the time and manner of your death. Again, defining now the issue, not about whether you are killing a patient versus letting them die, which is what most of this discussion hinges on, so that the actions, the causal path, and the intent look different, redefining the way that James Rachels did, and they know they're Rachels too. The issue is, are you allowed to decide time and manner of your own death, not having to rely on the luck of the draw of what it would take to decide the time and manner of your death? Do you have the right to control the time and manner of your own death? They argue there is a liberty interest in the 14th Amendment, and this is, they argue, no one should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. This is, of course, the part where we of the 14th Amendment where we get the abortion rights, and they argue time and manner of death is part of this. So, of course, in the 14th Amendment, this is just a small bit, and that's all it says, life, liberty, or property without due process. It, of course, does not mention birth control, abortion. All of that is understood to be the rights that come from this right to life, liberty, and property without due process. But they argue in this amicus brief that if you can decide the beginning of life, you're allowed to have an abortion, and you're actually deciding the beginning of life for someone else, or for a potential someone else, I'm not trying to bias us here, but you're trying to decide whether another possible human being gets to have life at all, and that's okay. How could it be the case that as a competent adult, I don't get to decide that I don't want the life anymore, that I don't get to decide the time and manner of my death? They argue that the liberty interest needs to be parallel. If we can decide the beginning of life, then we can decide the end of life, and even more so for PAS, because now you're talking about a fully competent adult choosing for herself. We're not talking about surrogates here. We're talking about competent adults. And then they follow this by arguing the liberty interest is secured by precedent. And they use two. Casey, which is, of course, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, which is an abortion case, a case that is trying to, from the Casey perspective, Casey as in Governor Casey of the at the time, Catholic Democratic governor who's trying to make restrictions on abortion. Casey loses. Planned Parenthood wins, basically. Well, it depends on how you see it. I know, you're right. Chipping away was done because there now had to be parental consent, but there didn't have to be spousal consent. And it did reaffirm the basic Roe versus Wade decision, but chipping away. So it depends on you're an optimist or a pessimist whether you're going to say who won or lost. So I take that back. But what the philosophers argue as that comes out of this case is a reaffirmation from the court that personal and intimate decisions belong to the competent adult, the realm of personal and intimate. And you can see where they're going to go with this, because could there be anything more personal and intimate, especially because you're not even involving a potential other person. Now you're only involving yourself. What could be more personal and intimate than deciding whether it's time for you to die or not? Cruzan establishes, extending this Casey reaffirmation, that I have a right to intend my own death. That's why I said that I thought the intention part of their argument against Quill was a little spurious when they argue that in withdrawal, the clinicians don't intend someone's death. I find that just patently false. Absolutely, they intend someone's death benevolently because they believe the body's already dead and it's doing no good, but they intend the person to die. They don't want them to continue on their service with food and hydration or whatever. So the philosophers argue Cruzan reaffirms that I can intend my own death. I can have my food and hydration removed at any point, even if it causes my own death. Well, then I have the right to decide time and manner of my death. And if I have the right to decide time and manner of my death when something is being intervened on me, I have some intervention, why can't I decide time and manner of my death when I don't have an intervention and I need some assistance from the medical establishment? So they argue, first they've argued there is a liberty interest. Then they argued to the court, you already secured that liberty interest by your own precedent. But the state knows that its ultimate trump card is to say that I have an interest in preserving your life, that I'm going to trump whatever right you have to time and manner, to decide the time and manner of your death by my interest in keeping you alive. And the way that they imagine and the way that the state has argued this is that I have to be worried about the abuses that will happen with PAS. With a ventilator case, you have someone who is obviously at death's door, at least this is the way the argument goes, and so you really are talking about somebody who could continue on like that or could go ahead and pass to the beyond or whatever. But with PAS, you could have all kinds of coercion that would be in the mix. You could have financial coercion, where someone that you mentioned, where someone doesn't really want to die until it's her time, but the financial burden of trying to stay alive is so overwhelming that they don't want to, that the person doesn't want to run down the family fortune or doesn't know how the person will feed themselves or whatever, or the person doesn't access good pain relief and so is in such terrible pain the person thinks the only option is pills, when actually good palliative care would have the person have a satisfactory death without this radical step. The state makes the argument, how will you prevent all those abuses? And Dworkin, in the voice of this cluster of philosophers, argues that the state has to prove that there will be these abuses. They can't take away liberty on the risk that there might be an abuse, just like you can't deny people the right to free speech, even though somebody might say something that gets everybody lined up behind some crazy candidate. So there is always a risk with rights that something untoward can happen that follows from having that right. But we don't in this country limit the rights, at least not unless there's extreme reason, and sometimes there isn't an extreme enough reason, we probably all think, but to have the state interest trump those rights. And that's their third argument. So they are arguing that the only reason why the court is siding against PAS is actually because they're anti-suicide. The courts the court members, the court justices themselves, don't like suicide. So here's what the court says. The 14th Amendment is not violated, because whenever there has been an extension of constitutional protection in this clause, it is conformed to fundamental rights deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. 35 years of fight on abortion seems to betray that as a good argument, because it does seem like we are certainly a 50-50 split on whether that right is deeply rooted in the history and tradition. But they argue that whenever there's, or the birth control, I mean, well, that's less controversial, probably was even at the time, but, or the Lawrence case, these are value-wise, deep-seated beliefs that there is entrenched views on both sides. So it seems like they're making it sound as if we've all come on board whenever there has been a recognition of a certain right. I don't know, it seems a little optimistic. And then they talk about suicide. Here, we're confronted with a consistent and almost universal tradition that has long rejected that asserted right. So we are all on board with pro-abortion, but we are not all on board with PAS. Something's wrong with that claim, obviously. So they say the decision to commit suicide with the assistance of another may be just as personal and profound as the decision to refuse unwanted medical treatment, but it's never enjoyed similar legal protection. We just don't protect people who want to kill themselves. And we do now protect people who don't want certain kinds of medical treatment. And then they get very profound. Throughout the nation, Americans are engaged in an earnest and profound debate about the morality, legality, and practicality of PAS. Our holding permits this debate to continue, as it should in a democratic society. Oop. Once again, affirming that states have the right to make pro-PAS laws or to reject them, but that they are not prepared in this point in the dialogue to see this in the due process clause, which I think really does reveal where they stand value-wise. At the time, the justices on the court were prepared to see a elective first trimester abortion in the due process clause. That's where they were. They were at that place, though not everyone in the country was or is. They're not at that place right now. I think that is what we can see. At the time, there was one state. Washington had just lost its popular vote, which then we know that it did a couple of years ago pass it. Other states were having dialogue about it, but it hadn't actually passed in the popular vote. There was certainly more momentum on the pro-choice side when Roe was decided in certain states, Mississippi not included, obviously, but in certain states. Go ahead. All right, I'm wrong about Mississippi. God love him, Louisiana. That's why we need somebody who really knows the law. Absolutely. Yep.
I forget if you already said this, but have any states outright banned PAS, like in a redundant fashion?
Not that I know of. Sorry. Is there any state that prohibits it? No. Yeah, the de facto is it's illegal, so you don't need to ban it. You just
Republicans love to ban redundant things.
Well, they are going to. There actually is. We're going to it. Oop, no, not yet. Oop, okay. So all I want to say here before I go to Gonzales is actually the attempt of the Bush administration to ban it federally. So no state bans it statewide because it's illegal, so it's banned. But what the federal government wanted to do was make sure that no other states passed it. Because a state doesn't actually have to get up all that energy to deny something nobody's fighting for. But there was a state that was allowing it, and the Bush administration didn't like it. So what they were hoping with Gonzales is that they were going to get a federal prohibition rather than what happened 10 years earlier was the hope of a federal permission. And that's Gonzales, as in Attorney General Gonzales, short-lived, versus the state of Oregon. And this is an interesting decision in my view, because you actually don't have the kind of court you had in Roe versus Wade, and yet we're going to see dramatically that the Bush administration's very transparent attempt to traipse over Oregon's decision, which was a vote-based decision, failed spectacularly, and we'll see how. So the Attorney General claimed that using a controlled substance, in Oregon at the time, for PAS was a federal crime. And that's how they were going to overturn the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, which interestingly, by 2006, had involved a couple of hundred people total. I mean, this is something that Oregonians and now Washingtonians and Montanaites love that they have, and almost no one uses.
Montanans.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't even know where Montana is, but I appreciate how to say it. These folks are very glad they have it. No one actually uses it. Very, very few people use it. But let's just ban it all together. That was the Bush administration's attempt. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. If the state law allows PAS, they reasoned, then you would have to be able to have the means to actually accomplish it. What's not inconsistent at all about this decision is that these were very state rights-based justices. States-based justices tend to not be activist justices when it comes to federal privacy-type stuff, because, of course, that you know they're not reading in the federal constitution a whole bunch of substantive rights. But it also bites you in the butt then when the states want to do something, because they are actually, right, John, they're actually pretty pro-state. So what they said here was Oregon already made this decision, and if that's the decision they made, and we've already ruled in 1997 that this is a state's issue, then we can't say that they don't have the means to do what we told them they had the right to do. So no way. And the interesting thing was, it was 6-3.
But they didn't have congressional action, right? There was nothing to clarify. So I don't think, I mean, this is basically the state of the Attorney General basically saying, look, under the Controlled Substance Act, all the doctors have licenses, and we have the right to have election, tell you how to do it. But they don't. But so they did, I mean, if they passed the statute, Congress passed the statute.
That would be bad. That would have been bad for Oregon. That would have been bad. But there was no movement at the congressional level. This was a Bush crusade with Gonzalez as the mouthpiece.
The policy they're trying to use an existing law and use it in a way that really wasn't foreseen.
Right. Which, you know, and it's their court that didn't. I mean, they liked that court until then.
Who were the dissenting justices?
I bet we could figure it out.
Thomas,
for sure, I was going to say. Scalia would be a second guess.
No,
and who?
Rehnquist was dead by then. Yeah. Roberts.
He would have, but he was dead. Oh, well. What?
I think John Roberts was already confirmed in 2006. But the irony is that on the other side, I think, in Washington, you had Kennedy, Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and Sandra Day O'Connor, and then everyone else concurred. So they, I guess, came to the same conclusion, but radically different reasoning.
It wasn't close at all, right? It was slam dunk against.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I've got. What else? Thoughts? John, any wrap up kind of?
Any questions?
Chava was an absolute non-starter. Cruzan had already said everything that needed to be said. So while we had Bush the...